This is Monocle on Design, our weekly look at the best in architecture, craft, furniture, and fashion. I'm Nolan Giles. On today's show, we visit M+, Hong Kong's impressive Herzog & de Meuron designed new visual culture museum. We learn about Maripedia, a pattern database by the famous Finnish fashion brand Marimekko, and we catch up with Lily Hollein. She is the director of Vienna's Museum of Applied Arts. All that coming up right here on Monocle on Design. Do stay tuned. But first up on today's show, we reflect on the sad passing of fashion designer Virgil Abloh. As artistic director of Louis Vuitton Menswear and founder of his own label, Off-White, he transcended fashion, making an impact in a number of creative fields, ranging from furniture design to music. To find out more about the man and the legacy he leaves behind, we spoke to fashion writer Dana Thomas.
I see the term streetwear as more of a catchphrase to define a way of making than, you know, what people might determine it as like a style of clothing. In my eyes, it's an art movement, less a fashion trend.
He's the one who brought street fashion to fashion, and now it's all about street fashion, as we know. He said streetwear wasn't on anyone's radar. It was sort of chatter at dinners, like, we should be doing something. Fashion needs something new. It's stagnant. What's the new thing going to be? And here I was crafting my ideas. He's the one who brought this to us, and now that's why we have the Supreme links. We have all these cool collaborations, and we're all wearing sneakers with our dresses and suits. That's Virgil Abloh. He's already impacted so much. First of all, he was breaking racial barriers in a way that was genius and opening that door to so many young talents where they couldn't have gotten through the door before. And he put some life back in, especially into couture, but, you know, into Paris high fashion. I went to a couple of his shows and they were cool. They were fun. And it was a completely different audience, not just in the VIPs who were there, who were sort of his hip hop friends, but also just a younger audience sitting in the chairs, not these stuffy Park Avenue ladies who are, you know, spending their husband's money. It was really a great vibe. And I think that will continue to ripple through.
The process and the end product are equally as valuable. I embrace imperfection as much as I embrace the pursuit of perfection.
And he did furniture design, all these interesting collaborations with Nike and with Evian and left and right. If someone said, can you do something for us or with us, he'd say, yes, let's do it. Because he felt like, you know, art and design should all be of a piece and it should all talk to each other. He said, everything I do is for the 17-year-old version of myself and that I believe in the power of art to inspire future generations. Everything had an aspect of design and he could touch it in some way and make it better.
I don't feel responsible to a preconceived notion of art. I feel more responsible to community that is trying to change the tide or live in an optimistic society that art, design, music, and fashion actually change the world for the better.
My thanks to Dana Thomas there. And now to Hong Kong, where in November the M+ Museum opened after years of anticipation and delay. The institution is one of the largest museums of contemporary visual culture in the world and houses what might be Asia's biggest and most significant collection of design and architecture objects. Monocle's Naomi Zhu Elegant sat down with M+'s chief curator Dorian Chung to discuss the museum and its ever-expanding design and architecture archive.
You may find other find our collections in other museums in Asia, whether, you know, if you go to Japan or Korea or Singapore, and some countries have already developed quite ambitious fine art or contemporary art collections. But it's very difficult to find any significant collection of design and architecture, and I would dare say all of Asia. So in that sense, this is first of its kind, maybe at this point one of its kind as well. Of course, design by itself as a discipline and architecture by itself is very large and very diverse, so we could have gone in so many different directions. So we really started from where we are, which is Hong Kong, looking at graphic design, industrial design, the very unique architecture and urbanism that are already internationally known in Hong Kong. Then, of course, we look at mainland and greater China to pick out certain topics as well as phenomena that we wanted to research and collect. Then we go to East Asia to look at countries like South Korea and Japan, and also thinking about the very strategic location that Hong Kong is, which is at the juncture of Northeast Asia and Southeast Asia. We also expanded our interest to South and Southeast Asia as well. But being in Hong Kong also means that we are, by history and by culture and by patterns of migration for decades, we're very much connected to also North America and Western Europe. A lot of objects and works have been collected from those regions as well. And of course, one of the best known acquisitions in this area is almost complete archive of Archigram. That is one of our, what we call anchor acquisitions in design and architecture.
Given that you have such a diverse and broad range of design pieces in that collection, how do you decide how to curate for exhibitions? For example, the current design and architecture one that's on right now.
You're referring to one of our six opening exhibitions called Things, Spaces, Interactions. It includes almost 500 works and objects, and that's not even, I would say, maybe about 20% of our collection of design and architecture there. Very early on, we settled on telling as quote-unquote classical or textbook story as we can tell. So basically chronologically laid out, really looking at the global landscape of design and architecture concentrically emerging from Hong Kong, East Asia, and the broader Asia, and the rest of the world.
And what are some of your favorite pieces from the current exhibition?
Oh, that's always such a difficult question. But for instance, when you go to the second room of this exhibition, then you see some of the architectural models that exemplify how architecture played such an important role in new nations being built in the period of decolonization. So you would see an example of a national building by Indian architect Raj Rewal, or you see a national stadium that was designed by Van Moleven in Cambodia. So when you see these models themselves are beautifully preserved objects, but you can really feel the sense of, there's an ambition, of course, in the scale and in the commitment to become part of modernist language internationally, but also the very fierce commitment and sense of duty that these architects brought to this project. So those are some of the objects that I'm very fond of, but towards the latter part of the exhibition, there's a concentration of postmodern objects, both from Asia and other parts of the world. Postmodernism often is considered as something of a blip in the history of design or fine art as well. But in fact, our narrative here is that it had particular resonance and relevance in Asia, perhaps because modernism didn't take as deep roots as in the West.
So one of the objects that you have there is the sushi bar, I believe.
Yes.
Could you talk a bit about what it was like to acquire that object? Do you even call it an object? It's so big, and then bring it to Hong Kong.
Yeah, I mean, it is a very large object. It is interior architecture, interior design. It is also a whole building in itself. It's a serendipitous acquisition, but then once we knew that this was available and it was possible for acquisition, it just made perfect sense. The Kyotomo sushi bar that you were referring to by Shiro Kuramata is perhaps the most iconic example of postmodern architecture and interior design. And what makes it even more remarkable is that interior design often in commercial settings don't get preserved. But this was preserved because the business went bankrupt and then somebody bought the whole restaurant. with the intention of doing something with it, but nothing happened. And so by happenstance, almost it got preserved. Through a curator's network, we found out that this was available and that we were able to acquire it. I think what makes it remarkable isn't just the fact that it was still available and possible for acquisition, but also that we decided to embark on that journey of preservation, of conservation, dismantling and packing and shipping all the way from Tokyo to Hong Kong, and then reassembling it. So truly remarkable part of that story is that the company that originally worked with the designer in the 80s to build, called Ishimaru, you know, a company of carpenters and stonemasons and craftspeople, like very Japanese style, very committed craftsmen, they are still in business, and many of the original craftsmen are older. They're much older, but they're still practicing. And all of them helped with dismantling a few years ago after we acquired it, but then also committed to reassembling it in Hong Kong. But then, of course, what happened is COVID, and that made the whole process much more complicated. But in the end, almost a dozen craftsmen came and quarantined for 3 weeks in Hong Kong, and they worked for over almost 2 months to put it together. And then they express the reason why they did it is because they are so dedicated to the legacy of the designer. One way that we talk about this really monumental, iconic building by Herzog & de Meuron is that this is our biggest design and architecture object. It's a building like no other in all of Hong Kong, maybe we can say all of Asia, especially in a city that is known for density, for the lack of land to build on. It's very generous and expansive building, almost radically horizontal podium, which is our second floor level that contains most of our 33 galleries. And that this is a sliver of a tower that we're sitting in right now. It's only 10 meters wide, but you don't feel that it's very narrow, but you can also see both sides of the tower. South side, you can have the view of Victoria Harbor, and north side, you see the skylines and as well as mountain ridges of Kowloon. You know, it's just an incredibly, almost unprecedented building in its transparency. We feel like very possibly the closest precedent that we can compare ourselves to might be Centre Pompidou, which opened in 1977. When it opened in the heart of the city in Paris, it completely transformed that part of the city, which is still felt. And also the vision of not just being the National Museum of Modern Art, but has a very significant part of its programming and collection dedicated to design, architecture, and also cinema, with significant research library added to it. In many ways, they are sort of our older brother or sister that we look to, and dare I say it, that we think that we'll have the same kind of impact locally and internationally with this new museum of M+.
Dorian Chong there. He is M+'s chief curator, and he was speaking with Monocle's Naomi Zhu Elegant. We'll be right back straight after this.
The forecast is Monocle's annual view beyond the horizon, looking to brighter days ahead. Let's see what the smartest and bravest have in store for 2022. In the affairs section, we take a look at the young entrepreneurs returning to Italy's south, bringing drive, talent, and long overdue investment along with them. The culture section explains how the world of dubbing has become something to shout about, as we meet a family-run firm giving foreign language film a voice. And in the travel pages, we head to southern Portugal, where a new generation of entrepreneurs is putting down roots in search of a higher quality of life. The forecast from Monocle is available to order from monocle.com or subscribe now. The forecast, a sunny start to 2022 is guaranteed.
To Helsinki now, where to celebrate 70 years of traditional printmaking, the Finnish fashion brand Marimekko has launched Maripedia, The online library contains over 3,500 of the brand's patterns, with new ones added each year. Our Helsinki correspondent Petri Bertsov met up with Marimekko's head of brand communications, Essi Tani, who took us through the Maripedia service.
Maripedia is our very own print encyclopedia, and it has been a dream of ours for a long time. The core of Marimekko is really art of printmaking, and our prints are unique artworks more than anything. They each have their own names and stories behind them. And Maripedia is our way of opening our print library to the public.
What kind of information can one find when browsing Maripedia? What's in there?
So this is an online print library that operates under our website marimekko.com. It presents Marimekko's most important prints from 7 decades and the stories behind the artworks. In addition, it offers selected designer profiles, since we really want to put our print designers forward. Maripedia is also an interactive platform, as our users can take a picture of a Marimekko print from physical environments with their mobile devices and search for it with the library's AI-powered image search feature to identify the print in question.
Do you think this tool will also be useful to, let's say, designers?
Absolutely. We really hope that designers around the world interested in print design or graphic design will find it. Such vast archives of artworks are not necessarily available for the public usually.
I know that Marimekko, throughout the decades of your history, you know, you've launched a lot of prints, but how many prints can you find on Maripedia?
Yes, so Marimekko overall has over 3,500 prints in our archive. And this is our way of opening part of our print library to the public. So in the first phase, we have over 200 prints, and in December, there will be almost 400 prints available in the library.
Let's talk a little bit about the background of this project. Why did Marimekko decide to launch it?
So we really wanted to create a service that is answering to a real need from our community. So some of the most frequently asked questions to our customer service or our social media have to do with our prints. So for example, someone from the US has found her grandma's vintage Marimekko dress and wants to identify the print. And also, since throughout this year, we have been celebrating our 70th anniversary with the theme of Art of Printmaking, launching this service is also a great ending to the anniversary year.
You already mentioned one use case example, but can you maybe mention some other ways of how Marimekko hopes that people will use the Maripedia?
Yes, so first of all, we see this as a great introduction to our brand and Art of Printmaking. And of course, as I mentioned, it is a service for our community to identify prints through the image recognition. But it also adds value to our online shopping experience as we link the prints to our product cards. So you can be surprised to find that a cup we currently carry in the assortment has a print from the 1960s. And this is really what Marimekko is about, since our design philosophy is truly rooted in timelessness.
You mentioned earlier that you have 3,500 different prints in the Maripedia. How important is printmaking to Marimekko today?
It is really the core of the brand. And we still have our operating textile printing factory at our headquarters here in Helsinki, where we print over 1 million of meters of fabric every year. And as I mentioned, the archive has over 3,000 prints, but it also continues to grow each year as our design team commissions entirely new prints from different designers around the world. And the printing factory also operates as a testing laboratory today for new innovation. So we have, for example, experimented with printing on innovative wood-based fibers. And currently we are looking at different botanical dyes made of onion or sumac, for example.
Since we're talking about prints, I do have to ask you, of course, what your own personal favorite print is.
This is probably the hardest question you can ask from a Marimekko employee. But if I have to pick, I will choose one of our first and most iconic prints, Piccolo by Vuokko Nurmesniemi from 1953. Piccolo is a print that exists in over 500 colorways. And it is used, for example, in the Joka Poika shirt, which is our classic unisex garment that has been in continuous production since the 1950s. And while this product is a classic, it has been reinvented on many occasions, and it has come out in plant-based dye this summer and just recently in an upcycled version. And I feel that this is truly what Marimekko is about. So staying true to your heritage, but always reinventing ourselves.
For Monocle in Helsinki, I'm Petri Burtsov.
Finally, on today's show, as co-founder and longtime director of Vienna Design Week, Lili Hollein has brought international recognition around contemporary design to the Austrian capital. Earlier this year, she was appointed head of the country's biggest museum of applied arts. It's a role Hollein herself says is a dream job for anyone from the design field. With more on the director and her big plans for the future, here's Monocle's correspondent in Vienna, Alexei Korolyov.
Most profiles of Lili Hollein will mention her late father, the famous postmodernist architect Hans Hollein, or her brother Max, director of the Met in New York. But her own persona is just as big. In September, she was made the first female director of Vienna's Museum of Applied Arts, or MAC for short. This follows 14 years at the helm of Vienna Design Week, an annual celebration of Austrian and international design, as well as a distinguished career as a writer, critic, and curator. In fact, to anyone involved with design here in Vienna, Lili Hollein is nothing short of a legend. And when she says that she's changed the design industry of the city, and indeed this country, and its perception in the world, you'd better believe her.
You cannot imagine that 15 years ago, when we founded Vienna Design Week, there was simply nothing. There was no event talking about design, gathering the design scene, nothing. So Vienna Design Week was and is a platform to think and exchange about design, and it's an international one. And I think that was extremely important. And it was not something that was very welcome in the beginning. We were sort of criticized, like, why don't you do something for the Austrians? We thought we did something for the Austrians by making them compete with an international crowd of colleagues. And by inviting, for instance, international journalists to look at our scene, to connect with people. And I know that we have really managed to put a lot of really talented people that I believe in to open doors for them in an international field. And this is something that would not have happened without Vienna Design Week. And this is why I'm really proud that we can say Vienna Design Week has changed the scene, because it has made things possible.
But with Vienna Design Week, I mean, you invented it, so you made the rules. But you come here, this is an existing structure, and it's quite a challenge, I think, you know, because you obviously have your ideas, you have your knowledge, but is there enough space, is there enough room to bring it in?
Well, I come here with my ideas and my vision, but I come with an extreme trust, and also I value the knowledge of our experts. It's about creating vision, about feeling where the direction goes, or what's the right topic. And I think this is what I have to come up with. I do feel the responsibility, I must say. Yeah, it feels, of course, different to be responsible for so many people as I am now. So, of course, it is quite a part of my job to make people cooperate inside the house and outside.
Besides the obvious and sometimes public difficulties of delivering your vision and staking out your artistic positions, there are other,
less visible challenges for someone like Lili Hollein. One is giving up control of something you've created, of your brainchild.
Well, it was Vienna Design Week took place only like 3 weeks after I started here. So I knew what I left behind, and I knew that they can push that forward. And I'm a mother. I think I couldn't be happier. I mean, of course, I will have tears in my eyes when my kid leaves at some point. I have now, as you can see, she's only getting 14, but I'm afraid of that moment already now. But at the same time, you couldn't be happier than to have the feeling that you prepared an institution in a way. It's 15 years of my life that have gone into that project. So of course I would be sad if I had the feeling no one cares about that. But in this case, I have the feeling the team of Vienna Design Week will really take it to another future. And I think it was the right moment also for me to leave as the last of the three founders that had been involved, because you don't change things from the ground if you're still in charge as a director. Yeah, revolution.
And then there's the sheer amount of strain that this kind of work puts on your personal life.
Okay, to get really personal, my husband and I split 2 years ago, so that makes me a part-time alleinerziehende, part-time single mom. And of course, that's another challenge, but I take up on this with the conviction I have to show other women that this is possible. It was the same that I returned to my job then 10 days after Ada was born. And I think she's quite a brilliant, happy child with almost 14 now. So it's very sweet that she's kind of proud of her mom and her mom's job. But to come back to your question, will or does it affect my personal life? Yes, of course it does. Of course you want to dance the night away again for once. And yeah, of course people look at you somehow a bit differently. And I have a different responsibility. I mean, especially in this period where we all have to follow laws and restrictions, I really look not only twice, but three times on how I act and who do I meet or not meet.
Like all other museums in Austria, the MAC is currently closed due to a national coronavirus lockdown. But it will hopefully open its doors again before Christmas. And when it does, there will be two new shows on display, in addition to its celebrated permanent collection. But that's not all.
In general, my plans for the MAC are to open up to a more diverse public, to open up to the scene even more than it has, and to try to engage people emotionally. I think this is so important, especially at the moment where doors are closed. The quality of feeling connected with a museum reaches far beyond the physical visit. Mm. We have to engage people emotionally to stay in contact with us. And that will be one of the major targets of my coming 5 years.
For Monocle in Vienna, I'm Alexei Korolov.
And that's all the time we have on today's show. If you're keen for even more design-related listening, then catch our five-minute midweek sister show, Monocle on Design Extra. It airs every Thursday. Today's show was produced by Charlie Filmercourt and Maylee Evans, who also edited the show. Thanks to our researcher, Nick Manise. I'm Nolan Giles. Thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.